each meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed.
Millennia ago, from the little cave on the tiny island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea, the heavens opened. Since then, the world has been fascinated by the cosmic upheaval brewing on the horizon of history. The upheaval is now upon us. It is within us. To some degree, it always has been. But there has been a sudden and violent shift in the affairs of the world. The winds have changed. Heaven will not be silent. Let's now join Father Anthony Bush, pastor of St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago, and author of A Mother's Plea, For the Winds Have Changed. Together we can pave the way for a hopeful response to the signs of our times.
Okay, yeah, I'm keeping going. Hey, good afternoon, everyone. Hey, this is Father Tom Coyce. I guess I'm sorry about that. And the show began, and I thought we were setting up here our microphones, as it were. And so, glad to be with you. This is our brain-wrinkling time of Winds of Change. Gee, that's never happened before, Nick. You know, this is do I need to put myself in the punishment room, or will that be someone else? Could be me, but I didn't have the right button pushed on these fancy instruments here in front of us. Well, God bless you for tuning in. This is Father Tom Coyce, and I'm very happy to try to get to you some words from somebody I've introduced in previous shows.
Wow.
I've been talking.
You just wrinkled my brain, man.
Yeah, let's see. This is the guy that wrote that book, Catholic Republic, that I've been quoting from a lot. And so let's see if we can pull him up here. And he's in between. He's one of these good teachers.
Morning. This is Tim Gordon.
Timothy Gordon. Is this...
How are you, sir?
This is Father Tom Coyce. Hey, you're live now on WNBZ, the Winds of Change radio show in Chicago. A nice... Catholic hour that we have here in the big city.
Beautiful. Well, how the heck are you, Father Tom? Nice to meet you, by the way, besides just texting.
Indeed. I feel like I know you fairly well, because I love your podcast with Taylor Marshall and all the rest.
Yeah, thanks. I'm getting that more and more. It's a weird thing. People will contact me and say, "Hey, man, I feel like I know you." It's kind of exciting, especially when the person's nice. It's kind of weird when the person's weird. It's a new phenomenon, you know?
Okay, before we dive into some great ideas that you present in your book, and I was a philosophy major as well back in Catholic University back in the 80s, and been interested in philosophical sides of religion and theology and life and all that, and you bring together so much great wisdom, I got to say. And I've been, unfortunately, I'm going to have to share with you a little strange side, because I've been using you and quoting you at church, and some of the people are saying, like, well, who is this guy, you know, and why do you love him so much? And you know how we used to say when we were kids, if you love him so much, why don't you marry him?
Great school rule.
That's right. But that brings some ideas about natural law that we just don't want to go to right now, you know. But I've been sent a few things, and here's they said, okay, you're going to interview Timothy Gordon. I said, yeah, I think I'm going to be able to get him on the radio show that we have here. We're not the major Catholic station in the Chicagoland area, but we are the best. How about that, you know?
Yeah, right.
There is relevant radio, and they do a good job in a lot of ways, but this is kind of an offshoot, and we got a lot of wonderful programming and everything. So, but somebody told me, okay, you're going to interview Timothy Gordon, and they reminded me of this. Do you remember this by any chance? Let's see if you're old enough to go back to the, I think it was.
Remember when you were in the Beatles and you did that album, Abbey Road, and at the very end of the song, it goes, and in the end, the love you take is equal to the love you make.
That's John Lennon.
Is that true?
Chris Farley show.
Yes, Chris, in my experience it is, I find the more you give, the more you get.
So that's Chris Farley saying awesome.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. Yeah, Chris Farley show, he did that so well. You know, he's the best performer of his generation, arguably, and yet he played a nervous guy as either Matt Foley on SNL skits or as himself on the Chris Farley show.
Right.
And, it was a beautiful thing. Hilarious.
It was. So, you know, the reason I'm opening up with that, Timothy, is that you're my John Lennon here. Yeah, it's like, oh, it's awesome. Awesome. you've really hit the nail on the head in so many ways. I just want to help sell more of your books, get people to dive into that. Natural law. Let's dive into it.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks.
It's such a bringing together of what we commonly call natural law with American history and the present cultural problems of the day. I'll say to my listeners, and then you could sort of try to unpack it a bit, because what I read you saying is that we're a republic, and like any good republic, you need certain ingredients for the republic to stand, to survive. And some of these essential ingredients really have deep Catholic roots. And we're losing them, or we've lost them. You want to unpack that a little bit for our listeners, just as an introduction kind of thing?
Sure. The first takeaway principle is to remember always that America is the land of contradiction, the republic built upon false dichotomies. And one of the recent ones that stems from the originary false dichotomy in American history, coming from our founding by guys calling themselves neo-Whigs. One of the current ones happening is, if you follow the debates between faithful Catholics, you know, guys like Pat Dineen at Notre Dame and the crowd that are calling themselves the Integralists, they're debating, you know, the crowd they see emanating from, like, Father John Courtney Murray from around Vatican II era, that are, like, I guess, dubbed the liberals. And the question is whether or not America is compatible with Catholicism. And so the big thing to take away, like I said, is that this new reopening of the debate, is America compatible with Republicanism? With Catholicism.
Right.
It's cutting, like all of these American debates from the 1760s onward, it's cutting into the meat without first boiling it. Like, what people have to understand is that integralism has a few correct premises. Those they're characterizing as the liberals that see Catholicism and smaller republicanism as compatible. They have a few premises, and everyone's screaming and shouting at each other from other sides. I do not argue that, along with Thomas and Aristotle, I do not argue that the only proper form of Catholic governing structure or political regime is a monarchy, right? Aristotle and Thomas say it's the best, but they say there are three viable forms: a monarchy, a republic, and depending on whatever you want to call it, you know, like an aristocracy or oligarchy. And all three of them will depend on the natural law. The republican form will depend on the natural law the most. and this is and how and why republicanism depends on natural law superlatively the most of all the three good forms of regime. You can pick, you can take your pick depending on the culture, which form any of them are adequate. It requires getting into the ingredients you're talking about. It really, republicanism depends upon natural law, the most of the good forms. So what the integralists are the side that basically say we need to go get a Catholic king, essentially. That's the only way to do it. The Catholic king who basically promulgates the missile, you know, from the throne and all that. They have some things right, and you know, they get a lot right. Part of it's we've taken separation of church and state too far. The heresy that Pope Leo XIII called Americanism, even though he liked our republic, that ought to stick out to the integralists right away. He liked the founding of our republic. He just didn't like how far the Freemasonic and the liberal influence was planning on taking this separation of church and state. And there's some other things as well, but they get some things right about the founding of America and the way that natural rights were enshrined here.
Yeah,
but they're not right that you're only a liberal. You're a liberal every time you say that republicanism can coexist with Catholicism because, quote unquote, liberals like John Courtney Murray got a couple things right as well. You can do a republic in a very Catholic way. As a matter of fact, the argument I'm making in my book, Catholic Republic, is that the only proper way to do these ingredients, and maybe we should just list them in a second, is actually by relying on the Catholic intellectual tradition, even if the Republic is not expressly Catholic.
Right. And you caught my attention right at the beginning of your book by going to Thomas Jefferson and, of course, the famous words of the Declaration of Independence, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness or property. And where are we at today? We founded a country and a republic with that sense of the natural right to life. And now we're fighting legislation that allows that abortion has gone way out of control, if it ever could be considered in control. But it's just getting more and more vicious. By the way, we have a good chance of having a new mayor in Chicago that's a lesbian. We just had an election for the mayor of Chicago, and there's going to have a runoff election, but one of the two is a self-proclaimed lesbian. So,
congratulations.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's not just that. Let's run through what the ingredients of a proper republic must be and let the audience judge how, quote-unquote, Catholic they are. Start out with, these are all derivatives, by the way, of natural law, properly conceived natural law. We're kind of going in reverse order from the way I pull it in the book, but it pulls out nicely anyway.
Yeah.
Natural rights are where I spend my first chapter. Natural rights are a derivative of the natural law. Generally speaking, everyone wants their natural rights because they're the goodies, they're the benefits, right? Not the burdens. And we want them, and even a liberal society wants them and usually articulates them.
Correct.
But if you do so in the tortured way that America did, it's a half-half kind of mud America between, I'll talk about this more maybe in a second, but it's a mud between secular left enlightenment principles and religious right Reformation principles explicitly. So it did it in a really muddled way of the mind. So natural rights, generally speaking, everyone wants, but now we look at our natural rights, life, liberty, property. It's not just that they're a bit muddled the way the intellectual tradition was a bit muddled, but they've been completely perverted, inverted, and now subverted, so that the right to life is actually formally repudiated by Roe versus Wade jurisprudence, even before, right? It is illegal for any one of the 50 state legislatures to honor the right to life. None of us are born with a right to life. We're all born by private good decision-making by our mothers who opted not to kill us, but it's illegal for a state to honor the right to life. Think about that. That's what Roe did. Abortion was legal in some states before Roe versus Wade in 1973, yet After 1973, it's actually illegalized for a state legislature to put a law on the books that acknowledges the right of life. It's illegal.
Yeah.
Federally, think about that. Same thing with the right of property. You know, you could go through the taxation schemes. Where you know, most people, if you total up all the taxes you pay, you're nearly 50% of your income, depending on where you are in the,
right.
the distribution. Mm-hmm. You're nearly 50. I mean, and consider, you know, that's the type of property, that's financial property. The founding fathers started lighting stuff on fire and tarring and feathering English lords and dumping breakfast beverages into the Massachusetts Bay because they received a small, untoward, you know, whatever it was, 5% tariff, not even a capitation. It's just a little tariff on the breakfast beverage. So
right.
they were much more serious about property rights than we are. Also, we live under something called the rule of eminent domain. Runaway eminent domain, meaning that the government can take your land anytime they see a fit purpose slash function after a 2005 Supreme Court case called Kelo. So there is
besides a war,
no even quasi-absolute right of property. I don't mean that in a technical, Thomistic sense, because people will get into it. I just mean in a sweeping way, there is no right of property anymore that's somewhat fixed. And then liberty, by and large, I don't have to be too specific here, liberty is by and large received in culture as its opposite, which is license, you know, or freedom for its own sake rather than ordered freedom. People, I think, have an easier time spotting this one. So natural rights are pretty much done. We're through the regime of American natural rights. That's my first chapter. Chapter two, subsidiarity, that's a Catholic concept. It just means local rule. It just means that the family is really the single-celled society, the Catechism says. Local rule, and that, you know, in the words of Pope Pius, it's actually immoral, unpleasing to God. Anytime a higher order of society does anything capable by a lower order of society, that's a done deal, too.
Tim, can you hold on just a second? He wants me to take a little break here. If you can hold on, can you give us a few more minutes after a quick break?
Surely.
Depending on, I know you're in between classes and what have you, but this will be a quick break, and we'll be right back, friends. This is Father Tom Coyes. You're listening to listener-supported The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
Celebrate the Easter Triduum with a beautiful liturgy filled with sacred music, incense, and candles in one of the most magnificent churches in the United States. You are invited to the historic St. Stanislaus Kostka Church, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy. The Triduum begins with Holy Thursday Mass at 7 p.m., Good Friday Liturgy at 3 p.m., Holy Saturday Mass at 7 p.m., Easter Sunday Mass at 10 a.m. St. Stanislaus Kostka Church is located just minutes from downtown Chicago at 1327 North Noble Street. That's 1327 North Noble Street, one block west of the Kennedy Expressway at the Division Street exit. Plenty of free parking available. For more information, call 773-278-2470. 773-278-2470. That's 773-278-2470.
The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ and on the World Wide Web at windsofchangeshow.com.
St. Stanislaus Kostka Church is the official sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago. Founded by Polish immigrants in the late 1800s, this historic church is more commonly known as St. Stan's. One church, many cultures, in that masses are held in English, Spanish, and Polish. The church is two blocks north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy. St. Stan's has been so prominent in the history of the church in Chicago that the Kennedy Expressway was even built around it. St. Stan's is easy to get to. It is the sanctuary for quiet prayer before the celebrated iconic monstrance. For Mass and confession times and special events, please visit our new website at ststanschurch.org. That's ststanschurch.org. And while you're on the homepage, feel free to click on the donations tab to help in the continuing restoration of St. Stan's.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. Father Tom Coyes here. Happy to be sharing with you some very interesting thoughts by a great young Catholic philosopher, teacher of today, Timothy Gordon. Can you still hear me, Tim? Are you stuck somewhere in between classes?
Yeah, sir. No, I'm good to go. I've prepared a bit, carved out some time.
Good. Maybe your class could say hello to Chicago too, or something. Sometimes I've done that on the radio. But anyway.
Well, I'd love to. They're on break though, so today's pre ACT day, so we're able to carve out some time.
Excellent. Here's one of the intriguing parts of your book that I think is right on the money, but it's difficult for me to exactly put it into words, but I think you can do a great job of it, and that is there's this bond and unity between the Protestant spirituality that was behind the founding of the United States of America and the sort of atheistic or at least agnostic spirit that is behind scientific advancement or scientific intellectuals. They come together in a unique bond and are spelling kind of doom for the progression of natural law and the necessary ingredient of having a moral populace in order for our society to survive. Can you unpack that a bit as well? Because I think I'm reading you
absolutely
right there.
Yeah. This is kind of where, this is the trajectory of the book. Natural law, you know, with all of its goodies, I went through the first three or four goodies, natural right, subsidiarity, virtue ethics. There's some more I talk about in the later chapters of the book, but basically the goodies, the derivatives of natural law that everyone wants, even the secular left, the grandkids of the Enlightenment, and the religious right. I'm not talking about, you know, deplorable right-wing Catholics like myself. I mean, religious right in the Protestant tradition, the Puritan Protestant tradition. The problem, so they want it. They want to sort of reify and did attempt as best they could to reify a sort of quote-unquote Enlightenment natural law tradition and a quote-unquote Protestant natural law tradition. It turns out that both of these, Enlightenment natural law / Protestant natural law, are contradictions in terms. The Enlightenment itself, the Protestant Reformation itself, was at bottom nothing but a repudiation of natural law, even though they in the political tradition wanted to kind of hold on to the goodies of natural law. So here's why.
Yeah.
It stems precisely from your question. Natural law is the thing objected to. Aside from maybe the hierarchical pyramidal structure of the Catholic Church and the sacraments, which are objected to, and, you know, episcopal lineage from the apostles, apostolic lineage, and the formal structure of the church, the actual philosophy being objected to in the 16th century, which is really the beginning of, depending on how you look at it, the Reformation and the Enlightenment, the way I cut it. I cut the Enlightenment a little earlier than most people, the onset of the Enlightenment. They are rejecting Aristotelian Thomist natural law. And the more you study this stuff, even though guys like Luther and guys like Locke, you know, Protestants and early Enlightenment thinkers were saying they still kind of like the natural law, they are utterly dealing with a nominalistic, anti-natural, true natural law tradition. They're incapable of doing it. The more into it you get, the more apparent it becomes. But they're rejecting what I call the three prongs of natural law that had always constituted natural law. We can go through it, or it might be a little specific for the radio, but that's why, come back around to your point, the Reformation looks so much and feels so much like the Enlightenment. One is just an intra-Christian rejection of the church. You know, that's what Luther was doing, but it's nominalistic for the philosophy students out there. One is an extra-church, extra-Christian rejection of church.
The world of science.
Outside of church. One's a secular attack, one's a new, whatever that means to be Christian but not in the church, sort of. Yeah. Christian attack on church. They're doing the same thing at the end of the day. They're two sides of the same coin.
Which is ironic in the sense that Luther began his fight because of moral corruption. He saw this is not good from the Christian perspective. The corrupt bishops or priests were bothering him, as rightly they should have, and they were bothering a lot of other good, holy people as well. But what he just took that the wrong way or too far, and the idea that if you can't show me an argument in the Bible, I'm not going to believe it, spills over to don't tell me arguments from nature. Nature is so corrupt. You're not going to convince me from just natural arguments. if that makes sense. You got to.
Right.
That sola scriptura came in and just ruined it for him. I'd say, and, you know,
right. Natural arguments are a form of paganism, for especially for Calvin, but also for Luther. Yeah, this is a staggering new thing to say. That I mean, I cut it up. The natural law is three views of nature. Nature is free and moral. Nature is intelligible. Nature is goal oriented. Luther and Calvin and all those Reformation guys will reject each of the three prongs of natural law for different motivations. They reject the three prongs of natural law just as fervidly as the Enlightenment thinkers will, starting mainly the next century. That's why I say the Protestant Reformation is just the beginning of the Enlightenment. And it's weird because, as we know, American Protestants, the ones that have remained socially and culturally and morally conservative, are arguably better combatants against the creep of the left, the moral creep of the left, than most Catholics are.
Even the Catholics.
This is a really staggering set of, it's a false dichotomy within a false dichotomy.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's true. Yeah, so they're really good, but I'm talking about the original Reformation was really related to the original Enlightenment.
This shed light.
It was the first moment of the Enlightenment.
I got to share a little conversation I had with our Right to Life March out in Washington. We've been taking young people to Washington, and you know, you get into conversations about the right to abortion and all that. And one of the good girls, good in the sense that, well, I think she is a good girl in a lot of ways, but she goes to church and she's very pro-life, and. And she would often say, "Well, can you give me arguments that don't stand on the Bible? Because when I talk to my friends in college, as soon as you say, 'Well, don't you know the Bible says this,' they say, 'Well, don't you know the Bible's just a myth or something of the sort?' They don't take the Bible seriously. So she's yearning for arguments extra Bible." And that yearning for is what you're putting your finger on, is that is the natural law that it certainly can be found in the Bible, but it's not only the Bible. Does that make any, you know, I'm sure you get that too in your with your young folks and everything around you.
Of course. Well, everyone wants to be able to reason outside of the Bible. That doesn't mean that reasoning from nature is higher than or even as high as the supernatural kind of figuring of divine revelation. It's not. But that's not the point. The point is that in life, we're flesh and blood. We walk about day to day. We're not all of us are theologians. And even theologians, when they're getting in their car or making decisions about where to eat for the night or where to send their kids for school, these are much more directly related to their natural reason than their theological reason about supernatural revelation. So
indeed,
people want to be able to reason this way. For Protestantism, it's basically off the table to be able to reason with your natural reason anymore. And, you know, they'll say, no, that's not true. We only want to reason soteriologically about matters of salvation from within the Bible. This ultimately isn't true. It's one of those sort of talking points that doesn't ring true. On the other side, for the secular left, whose grandparent movement was the Enlightenment, it's a similar kind of thing with opposite motives. It's always similar, but with opposite motives between the religious right and the secular right. They, too, have sort of written out of the capacity of man, for vastly different reasons, the ability to use or even talk about something called the natural reason, right? It's an obscure, Aristotle's four causes. They, in the early Enlightenment, insisted on lining out, getting rid of, extirpating the two most important four of the causes, final causation and formal causation. If you can't do that, then there are no real forms or essences. There is no real truth. Human reason is just a higher perceptive function, like a fancy animal or just a meat machine, way several of the atheists term it.
Oh, you know what? I want to underscore that because I know I have a real intelligent audience here, but that you touched on that. Just to help the people understand.
Wow.
Sometimes we wrinkle people's brains.
You just wrinkle my brain, man.
That's a little.
Right.
So I forget what movie that's from, but we like to keep people entertained during our show.
Yes.
But the teleological final cause and formal cause. Give that a little bit of understanding to the non-philosophical person.
Final cause is just a thing's reason for being, right? I mean, like, the final cause of Henry Ford creating a car is literally so people can drive, can get from point A to point B faster to drive. The formal cause of the car is the ergon, the intelligible structure, the idea of car, which is bound up in its function, and which car to car, you might drive a fancier car than me, I'm guessing pretty much most people do, but there's a binding conception that's common in nature, I mean, that really exists, quote-unquote, out there, between your car and my car. You sound like a pencil neck philosophy professor if you say it's something like carness, carness of the car. But there's something between any 200 cars that they have in common that make them, in nature itself, in reality itself, of a common type or sort. That, a butterfly does not fit into that sort. And really, at the end of the day, what's common between the Reformation and the Enlightenment that throws all this stuff off in differing, specific, but reliable ways, whether we're talking about natural rights, subsidiarity, it throws both the religious right and the secular left off, is the concept of nominalism. There's a strong strain of nominalism in both the Reformation and the Enlightenment that says that final causation and formal causation, the carness of the car, is really just a made-up human category we imposed on the world. And therefore, you're not able to, even though they want the goodies of natural law, I'm bringing it back around, actually, because I'll have to run off in a second. But but even though they wanted the goodies of natural law, the derivatives of the natural law, you can't do it from either perspective. From a Protestant natural law perspective, it's a contradiction in terms. An Enlightenment natural law worldview would be a contradiction in terms, because they reject these three prongs, and they reject really the intelligibility of the world, the purpose of the world, the moral means by which we approach the world, which is our intellect, if we're just high-functioning animals. People need to train themselves, this is the big takeaway, to see the Reformation, even though we all have Protestant friends that are really in love with Jesus in many cases, but people need to see the Reformation, the intellectual tradition of the Reformation, as very, very, very closely related, even maybe the same genus, different species, as the Enlightenment, what happened in the 17th, 18th centuries. It's just the early Enlightenment. They didn't go all the way. They loved Jesus, but they wanted to do away with the church. That was the ultimate goal. Of the Enlightenment. Yeah, my book is Catholic Republic. It was originally published by Dangerous Books, which is Milo Yiannopoulos' house.
Right.
It is now switching over next month. So it should be a pretty big release of the second edition on Sophia Institute Press. They agreed to pick it up when we ran into you know, Dangerous yeah. Books ran into a financial snag. So, yeah, I'm real excited about the release of it, and I really appreciate you having me on today. I'd love to come back on, in between classes. But it's been fun, and
I really
appreciate the opportunity to talk to Chicagoans.
Well, yeah, we're a strange little city here in a strange state, but we're doing our best, you know. Well, you're out there in California, so you can't brag too much over us in Illinois.
I'm 100 miles north of L.A., so it's a conservative little enclave in Bakersfield here, but I wouldn't go on for lengths about the stability of my political situation here in Central California, not by a long shot.
Exactly. Well, Timothy Gordon, God bless you for carving out some time for us. I'm going to keep on. When we come back from this break, I'm going to try to keep on unpacking what out of the points you have in your book. So God bless you now. Say hi to your wife and kids and to Taylor Marshall. Keep up the good work and all that good stuff.
Will do.
God bless.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
God bless. Bye-bye.
Hey, that was Timothy Gordon, and let's take a break here. So I'm going to have to try to unpack some of the many things that he said. They're well worth our thought process because they help us want to be a better Catholic. I guess that's the bottom line. I think most Catholics want to be as good a Catholic as they can, but this diving into some of this philosophical stuff, theological stuff, and comparing it to what is not Catholic and how what is not Catholic is ruining us, even in the sense of ruining the Catholic Church. There's non-Catholic stuff ruining the Catholic Church. We can put flesh on those bones here too, but let's take a quick break. I'm Father Tom Coyce. You're listening to listener-supported The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
Celebrate the Easter Triduum with a beautiful liturgy filled with sacred music, incense, and candles in one of the most magnificent churches in the United States. You are invited to the historic St. Stanislaus Kostka Church, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy. The Triduum begins with Holy Thursday Mass at 7 p.m., Good Friday Liturgy at 3 p.m., Holy Saturday Mass at 7 p.m., Easter Sunday Mass at 10 a.m. St. Stanislaus Kostka Church is located just minutes from downtown Chicago at 1327 North Noble Street. That's 1327 North Noble Street, one block west of the Kennedy Expressway at the Division Street exit. Plenty of free parking available. For more information, call 773-278-2470. 773-278-2470. That's 773-278-2470.
The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ and on the World Wide Web at windsofchangeshow.com.
Sometimes in life, we are confronted with the tyranny of choice. I know, stop or go, hot or cold, up or down, this way or that way. You can contribute to Winds of Change one way or the other. One way is to go to windsofchangeshow.com. Then click on Support Winds of Change Show in the upper right-hand corner of the page. The other is to go to ststandschurch.org and click on the radio tab to make your donation, one way or the other.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. God bless you for being with us here today. It was wonderful that Tim Gordon, who's like a real teacher at a real college, so he had to deal with classes and all the rest, and see if we can have him back again sometime as he so generously offered as possibility. So you can catch him he's got a lot of podcast followers and all the rest. I want to highlight some of these philosophical things he's bringing to fore and to bear on our problem with our country, our problem with our culture. And obviously it sticks with starts with and sticks in our own individual lives. He mentions a little word there, philosophical word that might have slipped by your bit. I want to unpack it a bit. He says that part and parcel of the Protestant Reformation, the intellectual tradition of the Protestant Reformation. I'm glad he, that's a very good phrase to keep in mind, because we don't want to belittle or insult or look down upon our many wonderful Protestant friends, good and God-fearing, Jesus-loving, devoted to the Bible. There is a tremendous amount that binds us in our common pursuit for God and our common love for Jesus Christ. So, but when you put that phrase, the intellectual tradition of the Reformation, it really changes the frame of mind or the kind of it should allow for better objective and really historical criticism is the phrase we sometimes use in talking about the Bible, but it can also be applied to any time in history, and the Reformation is certainly one of them. So the intellectual tradition, and one of the words Timothy Gordon threw out there was nominalism. That may or may not be a bad word for you. You may not associate it with hardly anything, because let's face it, we don't use it. It's not an everyday word. But for someone who has studied a lot of philosophy and theology, especially from the Catholic perspective, nominalism should be a scary word. It should be something that says, no, you can't do that. You can't mean that. Basically, what nominalism is, and he started to define it there, it's the thinking or the philosophy that says whatever anything is just what we call it to be. That is to say, things don't have a nature in themselves. We name them something, and our name creates the reality. Now, I remember hearing that back in my philosophy school days, it's a long time ago, and I never would have dreamed that there would be such a radically appropriate and very popular example in the news almost every day. That example is transgenderism, or the idea that you can call yourself, you don't even have to have any physical operation, you just identify as a male or a female. And the growing popularity of wanting to either be both or none or something else, a mixture of the two, that's a perfect example of what nominalism as a baby philosophy, maybe a few hundred years ago, has blossomed into. I can't say a beautiful flower, because I think it's more like blossomed into the weed, as it were. Our human life with our human bodies, you can't say that a human person is with this type of body a male human person and that type of body is a female human person. It's only what we call it. It's only what we've named it such. We meaning society, we meaning I name it myself. And so therefore, I have a right to name it what I want, as well as the unborn baby. That's another radical example today of nominalism. Here is a human body. It has human eyes, human hands, human heart, all the rest. But we are going to name it. We're going to name it a fetus. We're going to name it a non-person, whatever it is, a blob of tissue, you know. So that's the thinking behind the great moral crisis of the day. And what Timothy Gordon was pointing out, so I, you know, as much as I look at and study history, I never saw it as clearly as he delineates it in that book, A Catholic Republic. That what we call it is what it's what we want to call it, and we just kind of agree together on it. We don't have to investigate its nature apart from let's see what we're called in the Bible. I guess that certainly is a one of the responses against homosexuality is often God made Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve, which is a fine theological / biblical argument for marriage between a man and a woman, not marriage between two men or two women. But the acceptance of the gay marriage reality is because those who are not gay or nowhere near gay or what have you, they've accepted the reality or the philosophy, the way of thinking about things is we name things the way we want to. There isn't a innate, formal. Timothy Gordon mentioned the four causes of Aristotle, and final cause and formal cause are the two that he says are very important. It's important to know. I think I got to do a whole show on just those four causes because whenever we get into discussions, I'm sure most of my listeners do get into discussions and arguments and what have you. And whenever we talk about problems in the world,
you just wrinkled my brain, man.
That is a brain wrinkling time. Whenever you get into discussions, you always part of the discussion is, well, what caused this? How did we get here? What's the cause of this? And when we ask that question, we should have in our mind the four Aristotelian Thomistic causes, and the final cause, where teleology is found, the final cause, what a thing's being tends toward, that's completely lost in our thinking about things today. What do you mean? Something that has an innate teleology, an innate end. This is tending toward this. I remember my philosophy teacher would say something like, "You find a beautiful Stradivarius, a beautiful violin, carved out of the greatest wood of the land, and you pick it up and you say, wow, this is a great doorstop. Let's put this over here between the hinges. We gotta have a piece of wood here to prop this door open. You revolt against it and you would say, that's immoral thing to do because that violin, it's teleology. It's made for making music, not for stopping a door open. And you can see how this relates to the controversial issue of artificial contraception again. I come back to this theme so often, but it's important. It's important we see this because if you don't see how the male and female come together in the marital act, as we call it, if you don't see how there's a teleology to that, it tends toward the giving of life, you knock out natural law. And that is to say that you knock out the idea that there's something in its nature, in the nature of man and woman coming together again, that is goal-oriented toward the production of new life. That's why there's such a radical difference between natural family planning and artificial contraception, because the natural family planning couple doesn't come together in that kind of embrace in order to avoid a pregnancy that may not be the best for them at this time. But that realization that this tends toward new life and it's put in there by nature, and it's therefore, since it's in there by nature, it's God, it's godly, and that's why we just got to keep pounding away at all the political and social debates we get into. We always ask, well, what's the cause of this? And getting to those causes, the loss of the teleological element of nature is one of those causes. Now, you're not going to hear many people say that on news, on the evening news, but it's all around us, my friends. It is all around us, let's say. Another thing that, and I'm going to have to come back again to more of this, but another very interesting part of Timothy Gordon's book was as he analyzes the major founding fathers of the United States of America, the American Republic, or the American experiment, as we sometimes call it, he wisely points out where those folks are influenced. And most people, even in a high school religion, not religion, a high school history class, will be taught that many of the founding fathers were influenced by John Locke, philosopher in Europe, of course. And he was a Protestant and a good Christian. You know, I'm not going to disparage him about his soul or read his as a sanctity or lack thereof in terms, but he bought into the Protestant intellectual tradition, and he, as Timothy Gordon says, he then rejects this natural law written into nature, and that's why, if you can remember, he's the fella that really made popular the social contract theory of government. You've probably heard of that, but it's so very important to see why that's really not Catholic, and it's really turns Christianity, even from a biblical perspective, especially from a biblical perspective, inside out. What do I mean by that? Well, John Locke and his social contract theory sort of declares that how do governments get formed? People come together and agree to give up some of their freedoms to a particular body, namely the government, in order that the government can regulate the individual's freedoms, therefore to make an ordered society. So, in essence, he's the social contract theory of John Locke is saying that the human race, before government steps in, is wild, brutish, warlike. It's chaotic, and then man comes along and starts organizing men into a society. We come up with laws, we come up with offices, we come up with strategies and agendas and all the rest, and we enter into a social contract, and then we have order, and then we have peace, I guess you could say. But think of that, my friends, in terms of the story of Adam and Eve. It's kind of like the opposite of what I'm sure you, just like I, have been taught the story of Adam and Eve to be pretty much the opposite. The story of Adam and Eve says, at the beginning, the human race was wonderful, was harmonious. Of course, the human race only had two people, Adam and Eve. But the point is that the God-given, the natural state of the human race was good. Then it was man, in the persons of Adam and Eve, that messed up the paradise. See, and then we had chaos. Then we had to fight for whatever we can. We had to organize ourselves as best we can. But the point of Scripture is that God started the human race with a beautiful sense, a sense of harmony, a sense of paradise. We call it the Garden of Eden. And then it's man that messed it up. John Locke's social contract theory is sort of the opposite. Men, the human race, living on their own, such passionate individualistic desires and everything that at the beginning is chaos, and then man puts the order into it. It lost the sense that man destroyed the beauty that God created. Are you following me? And that's why one of the great influences in the American founders, and Timothy Gordon in his book, The Catholic Republic, he has a great lot of different quotes related. Thomas, he especially studies Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, first and foremost. Hamilton certainly comes in there as well. Certainly Hamilton was one of the ones who wrote a lot of the Federalist Papers. Madison, sort of called the founder of the Constitution. And of course, Thomas Jefferson is, his main claim to fame is the writing of the Declaration of Independence. But they all have, Timothy Gordon tries to get us to see where they were influenced. We're so enamored by them that we kind of take them as such pioneer founders of thought that they weren't influenced by anybody. But any wise student of history knows that's never true. I guess you could say Jesus came along and wasn't influenced by the people before him. Funny, that might even not be true, but he certainly brought in the greatest and the most long-lasting revolution of all. So, this sense of finding the Catholic jewels, the golden nuggets that we need, and Catholics can find them, and Protestants can find them, and Muslims can find them. That true sense of freedom that's not license, the true sense of subsidiarity that doesn't grow out of control with big government, that necessity of a moral conscience in order to take votes. So we got a lot to think about. We got a lot to pray about. God bless you for tuning in today. You've been listening to listener-supported The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
What's there to say when the world makes no sense? Do we search deeper truths or sit on the fence? Can you see? Can you see? Can you see the winds have changed? We marvel and flatter such meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed. Obscure, it does not take that long. Can you see?